Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
Charlie Rosen has made a long and sometimes weird career in basketball. He's played it, he's written about it, and he's coached it in such outposts as Rockford, Illinois, Savannah, Georgia, and Albany, New York. On the sidelines in the late and not particularly lamented Continental Basketball Association, he coached players who carried guns, players known to disappear with no warning, players headed for the NBA, and players headed for jail. When I had the opportunity to speak with Charlie Rosen about his new book, Crazy Basketball, I began our conversation by bringing up his early basketball days during which he played in the Eastern League against some of the players whose careers had been derailed by point shaving and game fixing in college. Charlie Rosen writes that those young men played without joy, which stunned him. I asked if that was because basketball was all about joy for him.
When I was 18 years old, it was, and that's when I first encountered them. And it was the time where I was first feeling comfortable on the basketball court, and I was a good enough player to have an influence, to have an impact. So my life was opening, was exploding, and I was very, very happy about that. And then to encounter these guys who were so, so good, down to the tiniest nuance, and they just played without smiles. It was stunning, as you mentioned, but it was also very sad and very puzzling.
How much joy do you see in the pro game today?
I think they're very happy when they cash their checks. I think they're happy when they win the championship or somebody makes a dramatic play to win a ball game. But I think there really is very little joy. I think they feel that they have everything coming to them, the fame, the money, all the perks. I think there are just too many things in the way that interfere with their really, really enjoying the game, as they did when they were younger.
One story from your Eastern League days involves a player named Dick Gaines of the Scranton Miners, whom you describe, and I'm quoting again, as a marginal criminal type. At least once, Mr. Gaines convinced an opponent named George Blaney to refrain from having a second great game against the Miners. How did he do that?
He threatened him with a gun, and he indeed did have a gun. I saw it in his bag, and I had known Blaney. I had played against him a couple of times during the summer, and he came over to me after the first game in which Blaney played very well against Gaines and said, "Hey, Charlie, this guy threatened me with a gun. What should I do?" I said, "If I were you, I'd step on the brakes, because he has a gun. Indeed, he does, and who knows what he will do." And that scared George enough to impair his play in the second game.
He shot something like 2 for 19 in the second game.
Right.
You worked as an assistant coach under Phil Jackson in the Continental Basketball Association, and there you found that it's fairly common for CBA players to simply vanish, or so you wrote. Can you give me an example or two?
Well, there was one player when I coached in Albany, the Albany Patroons. He had a habit of vanishing. What he would do is borrow money from people while he was on the team and then disappear, and totally disappear for like a year. And I eventually hooked up with this guy who had played in the NBA for a little bit and made a trade for him, and he was a great player. We went on a winning streak, and I thought we really had a chance to win a championship. And then one day, he didn't show up to practice. Nobody knew where he had gone to, and I haven't heard from him since.
Phil Jackson, of course, who was recently retired from coaching the Lakers, was spectacularly successful as the head coach in L.A. and with the Chicago Bulls as well. Was his talent apparent when he was coaching the Albany Patroons?
I think it was. He would see games in a different way. He would see the unfolding of a game in a very different way than other people would. I remember one playoff game we lost by about 20 points down in Tampa Bay to one of Bill Musselman's teams, and they just destroyed us. And sitting on the bench and afterwards, I thought there was no way we could beat this team. We had a shoot around the next morning, and Phil just changed a few things, the angle of a pick, a little hedging on defense in this situation, really minute things, and we came back and won the game. And that, I think, really convinced me that Phil had the stuff to be a successful coach in the NBA.
At one point during your days as Phil Jackson's assistant, the two of you attended a clinic featuring former Indiana head coach Bob Knight. Describe that encounter for us.
It was at a high school gym in Poughkeepsie, New York, I believe. And he was up on a stage with his hair lacquered down like he was wearing a helmet. And in the seats were mostly high school coaches, assistant coaches, everybody wearing their Banlon shirts with the logo of their specific team. Phil and I respected Knight's X's and O's, and we were looking for certain things. We were looking for maybe a zone trap or certain aspects of man-to-man defense. And all he did was bloviate. He talked about how he hated the media, the drug war. He said if he were president, he would make a phone call to Colombia, which was the big source of marijuana in those days, and say, you have 24 hours to shut down all your marijuana fields, or we're just going to bomb the country to smithereens and put up a parking lot. And it just, and everybody was cheering and yaying, and oh, Bobby Knight's terrific. He didn't say anything about basketball. So after we broke for lunch, everybody zoomed out of the building, and Phil and I were left there by ourselves. We took off our shirts and played one-on-one basketball. And we had a great time. We were all sweaty, and we just enjoyed it. And we stopped playing when everybody came back into the gym and when Bobby Knight came back into the gym. I'm sure he recognized Phil. He was he hadn't coached yet in the NBA, but he played for 17 years or so with the Knicks and then later with the Nets. He must have recognized him, and we just walked out. We left the basketball for dead and walked out of the gym.
Eventually, you became a head coach in the CBA. You ran the Patroons for a time and then the Rockford Lightning, the Oklahoma City Cavalry, and the Savannah Spirits. But you were told by the owner of the Spirits that you weren't, quote, sufficiently heartless to succeed in the coaching business. What led him to that conclusion?
Well, he was in Detroit. He was centered in Detroit, and he had someone drive him, actually, to Savannah just to check up on the organization and really to supply a transfusion to the front office. They were running out of money fast. And he brought a player with him. Would I give this player a tryout? And yes, indeed, I would. And I forgot his name, but the player he brought was a great defensive player, incredible defensive player. But he had kind of a mean-eyed, inner-city look about him. And to put him on the team, I would have had to cut someone else, a young man who had played at the Citadel, and I really liked. He was just a nice fellow. He played pretty good defense. He had an on-and-off jump shot. Reagan Truesdale was his name, and he was yes, sir, and yes, sir. And he just had a certain presence that helped the chemistry of the team so much that I couldn't bear it. Even though the guy brought from Detroit was a better player, I just didn't have the heart to send this guy home, end his basketball career, and just add another guy on the team who may have disrupted that chemistry. So I refused, and that's when the owner told me that I didn't have what it took to make it. He was right.
Well, you held on for a number of years despite
that,
though.
Well, there's nothing else I could figure out to do.
You write that in the CBA, anybody could be traded for anything. Keeping in mind that this is a family show, tell us a little more about some of the league's stranger trades.
Well, one player was traded for a sex act to be performed later.
Well, that was nicely done. I think that's okay,
even on
a family show. Good for you.
I once traded a player for a sweatsuit, but it didn't work out because it was supposed to be a double XL sweatsuit. I'm 6'9", and I got a large sweatsuit, which never fit. One trade happened because a team in Wyoming had this halftime stunt where they brought a car out to center court, opened the sunroof, and if you bought a program, you could make a paper airplane out of the program, come to half court, and throw the paper airplane. If it landed in the car, you won the car. The dealer who supplied the car said it was impossible to do. They monkeyed around with the fans in the arena to discourage that, but one guy succeeded, and they had to give him the car. And it cost the franchise, the Wyoming Wildcatters in Casper, Wyoming, it cost them $6,000, which they didn't have. So they traded their best player to me for $6,000. So basically a paper airplane was the impetus for that particular trade.
At least once, if I read this book properly, it seems to me that you traded a player in order to get rid of that player's wife. Have I got that right?
Oh, yeah. I won't mention his name, but he played in the Big Ten, and he broke a finger in training camp. And he did nothing to stay in shape. He didn't run laps. He didn't even come to practice. And when the season started, he was ready to play. But I didn't play him, and he had been a starter the year before when someone else coached the team. So I just thought I'd kind of feed him in and play him 4 minutes or 5 minutes until he got into the swing of things. And after the very first game when he didn't start and only played a couple of minutes, his wife just jumped me after the game and started screaming curses at me. And how could I do this? So I just got on the phone and immediately traded him.
It must be nice to have that kind of power.
Well, yeah, you know, that's the one advantage that the CBA had over the NBA. The NBA, you have to worry about no-cut contracts and equitable salaries. And college, you can't trade anybody. So the CBA was really, really good for that.
There were a lot of frustrating nights in the CBA, but only one of them landed you in jail. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, I knew you'd bring that up. Well, it's a long story, but the short version, I was the senior coach in the league at the time, and Eric Musselman was coaching. He later coached in the NBA. He called me up. He said he had just played a game in Cedar Rapids, and the coach there put a full court trap on with like a minute left to go, and his team ahead by 20 points. Would I speak to him about it? So I did. So anyway, I cornered the coach and said, hey, Eric told me you did this. And he said, no, I don't do that. I never do anything like that. He's wrong. Okay. So we play the game. We're competitive for the first three quarters. We get blown out in the fourth quarter, which irritated me anyway. And the same thing happened. He's up about 15, 20 points with a minute left to go. And he calls out red, which is usually shorthand for a full court press. And he put a full court press on. So I got up and screamed down at him, what are you doing? And he cursed me and said, if you don't like it, come on down here and do something about it. So I did. I went down there and tried to get at him, but one of the referees grabbed me and pulled me away. Of course, I was thrown out of the game. So I'm in the locker room fuming at the owner, at the game, at the other coach. I had a lot of things to be mad about. And I decided to go out into the hallway to get a drink. And the game happened to be over. And there was the other coach preening in front of the media, saying what a hothead I was and blah, blah, blah. And I should stick to writing poetry, of all things. So I ran at him and took a couple of wild swings, which didn't connect. The cop appeared out of nowhere, threw me to the ground, put his knee on my chest, and my players surrounded him at the time. Like, hey, you know, leave him alone, leave him alone. And this little white cop kind of looked up and saw these, you know, 6'9", 6'10", black guys circling him, and he reached for his gun. So that set me off again. You know, who are you going to shoot? How many bullets you have? You going to shoot all of us? So he kind of let us go, went into the locker room. 10 minutes later, a riot squad came, pulled me out, threw me up against the wall, beat me with the batons in my legs, threw me in a squad car, took me to jail, booked me, and I spent about 3 hours there. My players pooled their money to bail me out. They had a meal waiting for me, and they all told me about the times that they were in jail and were very happy that I had stood up for them.
Charlie, I won't ask if you miss the late lamented CBA, but do you miss basketball?
Let's see. Well, I certainly miss it now that there's no NBA season. I miss that. I miss playing, and I don't miss playing. I miss being 20 years old and playing, that's for sure. I don't miss playing in my later years. I played till I was 52, 53, when the only times that I was pain-free was when I was playing basketball. It did take me a while to feel comfortable not playing. But I also realized that I was never really talented, but I was big and strong, and I could shoot, and I could do a couple of things. I could set a great moving pick, terrific moving pick.
Which is, of course, illegal.
Of course. Not in the Bronx, though. Not where I grew up in the Bronx, it isn't. So I miss the camaraderie. I miss the freedom, the flow of the game. I miss that. And every time I heard a ball bounce for a couple of years, I kind of got a heart pang. But now I don't miss it at all.
Charlie Rosen is the author of lots of books having to do with basketball, the most recent of which is Crazy Basketball, A Life in and Out of Bounds, published by the University of Nebraska Press. He spoke with me from WAMC in Albany. Charlie, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, again, thank you very much for asking me to join.
My conversation with Charlie Rosen will be featured in this week's show. I'll also be speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Gay, who's come up with a terrific way for NBA players to continue entertaining their fans if the lockout drags on. We'll be updating the negotiations between the NFL and their locked-out players. We'll explore how Major League Baseball is trying to prevent broken bats, and we'll have a story about competitive kite flying in Bali. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.